Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and hosted by Eli Mazur. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app, share it with others, and leave a 5-star rating. This episode features an interview with former administrative patent judge Joe Lentovich. While the USPTO's Patent Trial and Appeal Board, the PTAB, gets most of its attention in the news for its post-grant proceedings, most of its work involves deciding ex parte appeals. An appeal is usually filed after a patent examiner refuses to grant a patent. The appeal is assigned to a 3-judge panel of the PTAB. While one judge is designated to write the decision, all 3 judges are supposed to take an active role before the final decision is issued. On this episode, Eli and Judge Lentovich discuss many subjects, including how Judge Lentovich became an administrative patent judge, how the PTAB operates, what it takes to win an ex parte appeal, and Section 101 rejections.
Today, we're lucky to have Joe Lentovich join us, or should I call you Judge Joe?
Joe is good.
So full disclosure, me and Joe, we worked together for a long time. Then he went to become a PTAB judge, and now he's back at our firm. So me and him have been these conversations a long time about the PTAB, how it decides ex parte appeals, how it works, and so forth. And a lot of the wisdom that you shared, I've passed it along to other people. And I thought, finally, you know, I should just have you tell the story firsthand, share that wisdom firsthand, and give that advice. But before we get into that, I really want to talk a little bit about your background. So before you ever became a lawyer, you were in the Marine Corps in the 90s. Can you tell us a little bit about how that was?
Yeah. For me, joining the Marine Corps was the best thing that I ever did. Throughout my 4 years of college and immediately after, if I wasn't the most irresponsible person in the world, I was in the conversation. I was all about having fun, you know, and life was my roller coaster. Like, I loved it. And I honestly thought joining the Marine Corps was going to extend that period of excitement. Like, I mean, I was drawn in. Like, I was an adrenaline junkie. And I thought, here we go. Like, this is the ultimate. Yeah, that didn't happen. So I was an artillery officer. And in the Marine Corps, when you go to officer candidate school, if you don't want to be a Marine and you don't want to lead Marines and everything that means in the Marine Corps, they will weed you out quick. And I grew up, I did it. So I was 22 years old and I did 20 years of growing within that little 10-week OCS class. You know, my parents were happy because they finally got the adult they thought I should be, but yeah, it was not fun. The 90s were interesting because the Clinton administration cut back a lot of the funding, from what I remember, but didn't cut back the operation. Like, we were still deploying. And so from my experience in the artillery battalion, we had 3 firing batteries. One would deploy. One had just come back from deployment. One was getting ready to deploy. That was the rotation. All your good gear, all your good Marines, your good gear went to the deploying unit. They got cream of the crop. All of your we can fix it stuff, that went to the unit that was getting ready to deploy, because once you get assigned to that MEU, which is a Marine Expeditionary Unit, there's more money. You can fix this gear. That unit that just came back, you get nothing. Like, you got all the broken stuff. Most of your Marines are gone. So say there's roughly 160 Marines in a battery. When we came back from my first deployment, I mean, we dropped down to like 60 or 70 Marines. Like, instead of having 6 guns, we would shoot 2. And I told you once, we went on a 30-day field operation. We had enough ammunition to shoot 10 rounds a day. That is the most boring thing in the world.
Like, so each person 10 rounds? Is that
you could try and space them out. Like, so 1 every 2 hours. You could just have yourself a little 10-30 minute period of excitement, shoot all 10, and then just do other stuff.
So they had all these Marines, but they wouldn't provide them with the bullets to practice with.
Yeah, no money. Like, the money had to go to the units that were deploying or deployed. And then all politics aside, when President Bush, the second one, when he came in, the checkbook opened up and money came. I mean, we went from using the old Vietnam era Deuce gear and stuff to getting the new Molly gears, and all of a sudden the M16 got phased out and they went to the M4. Like, it was like Christmas. I mean, it was, that was a good time. But I got out shortly after that. I got married, and I think my last 3 years of service off and on, I was gone from home 1.5, 2 years. And my wife was like, I'm good with that. Like, I knew what I was signing on for, but I'm not going to be a single parent. Yeah. Like, so if you want to have children, you got to get some job to be at home. And there are things you can do in the Marine Corps that are more stay-at-home things, but that if I want a stay-at-home job, I'll go. I joined the Marine Corps for the excitement. I liked deploying. I liked the fun stuff. The idea of, like, being a recruiter or, well, very important, and those guys do a great job. That's not me. I'll go do something else. I did not know what to do. I had an engineering degree. I never worked as, besides summer stuff and like little temp work while I was waiting to go in the Marine Corps. Like, I didn't have a major experience or whatever, engineering. So that wasn't really an option. Two of my friends from the Marine Corps who had gotten out had gone to law school, and they were like, and you gotta do it. It's a blast. And I'm like, I'm not really a school guy. Like, I'm an outdoor guy. Like, but I took the LSAT test. I did well, and kind of left it there. Was getting out. Was going to go work for some company, be a manager or something. And I got a random call from the University of Akron, and they said, you want to come to law school? So we'll give you a full scholarship. I said, oh, yeah. I said, well, I'm in the process of moving to Florida. All my stuff is in Florida. You're in Akron, Ohio. Like, I don't have a job right now. Like, I said, we'll give you a stipend. And I'm like, what's that? we'll give you money. I said, okay, you got a deal. And school started 2 weeks later. Literally, I never lived in Ohio before. I'm from Buffalo, but had gone to the Football Hall of Fame, which is in Canton, which is close. But besides that, knew nothing. My wife's from Alabama. She's like, does it snow there? I'm like, a little bit. And she was like, oh, let's do it. And we drove up, and school started Monday. We got there like a Friday night, Saturday, found an apartment, just the first one, like that it's a little townhouse. Rushed to the bookstore to get books. I remember, I'm walking out of the bookstore with a big armload of books. And my wife is like, don't you feel so proud, like so exciting? I said, I feel like some big pop-up kid is going to come and knock these books out of my hand. Like, you know, what am I doing? Like, what am I going back to school? Like, this is the last thing. And I never heard of patents or patent law. After my first year, this partner at an Akron law firm called over the school, said, I need an electrical engineer, patent attorney. Me and one other guy were the only two electrical engineers in law school. So the career counselor or whoever, you know, calls me up or finds me. He's like, this is what they're looking for. Do you want to be a patent attorney? I'm like, what is it? And that guy didn't really know. I mean, he knew more than I did. So his little explanation made sense to me then. But you look back and you're like, yeah, you didn't have a clue.
So what did he tell you?
Some weird stuff, like you create inventions or... I had nothing to do. Like, I went on my, because it was like quick. I said, yeah. He's like, well, the guy wants to meet you for lunch today. I'm like, well, okay. Like, I got a wife. We got an apartment. We're going to pay rent. I need a job. I'm not being like, well, let me be selective. This guy wants to meet me. He might offer me a job. I'm going to lunch. And I remember, like, he is talking, and I'm thinking, I wish I had pen and paper to write down some of these words and go back and figure out what they mean, because I don't know what he's talking about. So the next semester, I took, like, the intro to IP class or whatever, and then I took a night course with a guy that used to be a patent attorney at Goodyear, that would have been a great class if I would have had any idea of what a band was. Like, it wasn't like a starter class. Yeah, I ended up going to work for that guy. I graduated a semester early, so about a year later, I actually had an offer to go to the patent office to be an examiner. My wife was pregnant with our first child. So however the dates were going to match up, my show up for that patent course, whatever they do, the training, was like 1 week before the due date or something crazy. So I call up human resources and I tell her the whole situation. I said, can I move it? She said, no. I said, what are my options? Yeah, she's like, don't show up and don't take the job. I was like, seriously? That's my option? Like, she's like, yes. Click.
So what year was that?
That was 2007. The funny thing is, the guy that recruited me, he had come to the University of Akron on a career fair, Carl Whitehead, is a judge of PTAP.
Oh, that's funny.
And he's electrical. Like, we worked together. He didn't remember
me. You actually helped me, I think, prepare for an oral hearing with Judge Whitehead. So that was a...
Yeah, he's a great guy.
And he was an examiner at the time, or...?
He was
a judge already.
He was still with the, whatever that side's called, the patent side.
Yeah.
The board yet. But he wasn't...
Examining.
Yeah, he was... like, he had been a SPE, and then he got this... whatever he was doing, going out to different colleges, doing career fairs.
So he was a recruiter for the USPTO instead of the Marine Corps.
Yeah, he was a Marine. We used to joke about that all the time. But I told him a story, like, I tried to come. I thought he wouldn't change my date. And he's like, are you kidding me? I'm like, no. Like, he's like...
All his work down the drain.
Yeah, because, you know, at that time, they were scrambling for electrical examiners. Like, when I showed up at the career fair, he was like, yeah, what's your name? Like, we sat down on the computer, that new little electronic application process had just kind of come out. So you had to put your stuff in there. We did it. And he's like, don't even worry about that. I know exactly where you're going. Like, and so I was pretty excited. So I ended up going to work for that guy I had lunch with. I stayed there till 2010. And, then I went to Harity for the first time.
So that's quite the journey. And then you had your practice mostly focused on patent preparation and prosecution. I want to talk a little bit about the process of how do you become a PTAB judge? Do you have some political connections? Is that how that works? Or
No, I wish. So I knew, like, when you file your application on USA Jobs or USA Gov, whatever that is.
Yeah, USAJobs.gov, I think.
Yeah, that there's a... automated process. Like, you could Google it or do things. Yeah. They're counting points. Like, you're getting a score on your application, and it's not by some patent person or whatever. It's human resources. So you make sure you have words in the job notice in your resume, like, you know, and you say things 3 or 4 times just in case. Each time you say it counts another point. So I read up on all those rules and I did all that. So I got an interview, and during the interview, it was Chief Judge Smith. So they did the interview like a hearing, like a oral hearing. Chief Judge Smith.
So you were standing up there and they were sitting as judges? Is that the idea?
And they asked me when I came in, they were like, have you ever been in a courtroom before? I said, well, I went once. It was the day the bar exam results came out. And I carried boxes in. I think it was a Markman hearing.
I thought you were going to say when I was a defendant, I was one. No. No, I mean,
yeah. But so I had no idea. Like, I didn't even know what you call these guys. Like, And my experience doing personal interviews with the examiners and going there, I didn't think very highly of the PTO in general. The big draw for me was the telework program. My wife was from Alabama. She really wanted to move back. She actually saw the job somehow. It was like, if you take this, we could go live in Alabama. And I was like, I'll try. But I had told her going to interview, if it's a clown show, no way. I don't care where we live, what kind of money they offer me. I can't work like that. Like I'm not gonna have some guy in cut off shorts and flip flops. Hey, dude, what's going on? Like, no. So the first thing she asked me when I got home was, how was it? And I said, I think it's the adult wing of the patent office. Like, I was very impressed. Like, people wore suits. They were very professional, courteous. Like, they knew what was going on. But so Chief Judge Smith is up there, and he's peppering me with questions. That guy was like, and I later learned that's his personality. Like, he's a, like, I'm going to keep at you. And if I sense weakness, look out. Like, and he does it in a nice way, I guess, but it's not fun. But he said, how many responses to office actions do you think you filed in the last 4 years? And you know, Herity, we track everything. Like, and for some weird reason, I knew my number. I still know it. At that time, it was 3,213. Like, but I told him, I said, I know it's over 3,000. Like, I don't want to tell him the exact number. Like, yeah. I don't know. I didn't want to think like, I track this stuff all the time. He was like, what? No, the last 4 years. I'm like, yeah, last 4 years. Like, he's like, how is that possible? I said, it's what I do. Like, we work hard. And so we just track everything. And I used to beat me. And I'd be like, I'm not even the top guy. Like, I'm two or three. Like, depending on what Paul Gerzo does, like, I could be third in the list.
Who's a partner at a firm?
And the three of us were always kind of battling. No one. I never beat Eli. We had a trophy. Used to get the trophy for being the.
You're not allowed to embarrass me on my podcast. That's
Eli got the trophy every year, and then they stopped giving it for production. That's what I remember, because you couldn't beat him. And so I don't think you were married then. You definitely didn't have kids. And I was like, that's an unfair advantage. Like, just, that guy's not going home and having like to do bedtime. Like, no one's calling him up saying, are you coming home yet? But it was fun. So he couldn't believe it. I know they checked. I can find out later. This guy, Al McDonald, who's a judge. Alan's one of the smartest guys I've ever met. And he ended up being one of my mentors when I first started. We kind of talked about it. He's like, oh, yeah, I had to check that number. Like, that's outrageous. He goes, and he told me that the real number, so it was higher than 3,213, but he's like, we couldn't believe it. And then I got lucky. I had only gotten back like three decisions on appeal, because remember, it used to take, probably still does, yeah, years. And I had gotten a string of them back, and it just so happens that all three were reversals.
And I like to say better to be lucky than good, but also good to be good, right?
I would like to say it was all skill. But all three were cases where if the examiner had been remotely reasonable, never should appeal. The most egregious, it was a 102 rejection, and he was saying in the office action, yeah, the reference doesn't teach it, but it would be obvious. And I call him up. I'm like, hey, you got to change it. That's not a 102. It might be a 103, but you got to change it. He wouldn't. Like, he wouldn't even agree that it was a bad 102. And he was such, like, not enjoyable to work with. I was like, I'll appeal this. The only thing I remember about the appeal brief is I was careful not to say anything about whether it's a 103 or not. Because it probably was. Like, I don't remember it being, like, a bad 103. It just wasn't 102. And I don't even know why they didn't give me a new grounds rejection, but they didn't. They just reversed. So the chief judge asked, have you gotten a decision back? I said, well, I only got three back, and I've gotten back recently. He goes, well, how'd you do? I said, they were all reversals. And he goes, how is that possible? I said, how is it not possible? Like, I don't know, was there a gimmick? Like, do you got a quota? Did I exceed my quota? Like, he told me that the affirmance rate for the board was about 60 some percent. He said, so how do you explain the fact that you're basically at 100%? I said, I only appeal when I know I'm right. I don't know if that's why they decided to hire me or not, but it was kind of funny, lighthearted, but the whole tone and like the interviews kind of changed. Like it got relaxed. And I always thought maybe that was it, but they probably still have, I don't know if I'm breaking some rule by telling you, but one of the questions is basically, if the director or somebody comes down and basically tells you, you know, it'd be really good if you decided this case this way, and you had already looked at it and decided that it was going to be the opposite, and just change. And I was like, well, no. And I'm thinking, it's an interview. Like, I know the correct answer to this question. I don't care if you really would. The correct answer is no. Get the job, do what you want. Like, if that's your, you're scared of the director and you think, oh, he said, but you don't say it during the interview. I don't remember Chief Joe Smith, but I guess he didn't believe me, or he must have somehow known that I was like, interview question. Like, and he came at me, oh, you wouldn't? I'm like, no. Well, now it's just like a bully, not a bully concept, but like one of those, I don't know what the correct term without throwing out some inappropriate language, but you know what I'm saying? Like, two guys, like, I'm not backing down. And it must have been about 2 or 3 minutes, which during the interview is a long time. I'm just basically going back and forth saying, no, I'm not changing my mind. And he's like, well, I don't believe you. I said, I'm not changing it now, and you're being pretty insistent, and I want this job. Like, so why would I change it after I already got this job? And he was like, he was tough. And so I did the interview, which, let's say, I'm guessing, but let's say it was May. I got called in October and offered the job. So you have to get appointed by the Secretary of Commerce. So if they decide they want to hire you, they send up the names to the Secretary of Commerce. Whenever the Secretary of Commerce gets around to it, they approve or say yes or no. Once they get that approval back, then they can offer you the job. So they had told me this, and they said 6 weeks. If you haven't heard in 6 weeks, call. So I call Human Resources after 6 weeks. She was like, no, nothing's back yet. I called about 3 weeks later. She's like, nothing's back yet. And I said, well, if it was a no, that wouldn't take 9 weeks to figure out. Like, if you didn't even send my name up, we know that one already. And she was just like, all I can tell you is there's not a good decision back. I'm like, no, seriously, logically, that makes sense, right? The no, like, that's the day one decision. Like, I'm getting that letter, like, right out the gate. Like, we're just waiting on someone, right? Yeah, I gave her a pretty hard time. So when I showed up for that orientation where you check in or whatever, she was there, and she's like, oh, I had to get eyes on you. I was like, yeah, pretty good.
That's interesting. So I guess once you join the board, how does that work? Do you get to decide if you want to handle ex parte appeals or trials? What technologies, how does that work?
So your technology is going to be based on your degree and experience. So I have a degree in electrical engineering. So that got me into the electrical cluster. If I would have had like work experience or something, chemistry or mechanical.
So the clusters, is that an official thing, or it's kind of...
I think that's what we called it.
Okay.
So all the electrical judges, like, that's all I worked with. So there's 270 some judges when I left. I probably worked with 30 or 40 of them. If you were in the chemical section, I might recognize your name because I saw it on a sheet or something, but I never worked with you on a case.
So this was a cluster of judges who just handled ex parte appeals for electrical. There's about 30 judges who do that, for example.
Yeah, I think that 30 or 40. I think we're the biggest group. When I started, the backlog was huge, up over 20,000 cases, 30,000. I don't know if it hit 30, but that was like the talk. Like, we got to get the backlog down. And a good percentage of them were from the electrical groups. So 2,100, 2,400, 2,600, I think. I might get that number wrong, but if an appeal came from one of those TCs, whoever at the board, some administrative section that did the docketing, they would assign it to someone in the electrical group. So I had a lead judge, like a supervisor, and those weren't by like background. So there was people that did AIA cases, there was chemical, electrical, like, it just was some administrative group. The ones I worked with, the electrical was big enough, they broke us up into two different groups. So I really only worked with about half of the judges. And then if you were electrical and did AIA, I didn't work with you. But everyone starts out with ex parte, and then you can ask to go to AIA. A lot of people came with litigation backgrounds. I think they specifically wanted they applied for the job to do AIA cases. And that was the big, especially when I started, that was like the shiny jewel in a jewelry store. Like everyone wanted to do it. So you definitely didn't have to. I really liked ex parte. I still like prosecuting. I'm not a litigator. I don't care for litigation. And they had to know a lot. Like those guys get into joinder and all those words that I vaguely remember from law school, but I didn't care about. There's no joinder in an ex parte case. Like, so I never did it. They ask every year when your annual review comes up, your lead judge will say, I think there's like three questions. Like, do you want to work on another technology that you're qualified to work on? Do you want to do AIA or ex parte cases? I know there was three. I just don't remember what the third thing, but I liked ex parte cases. I really liked the judges in the electrical group. They were smart and they were easy to work with. Like you could disagree and sometimes your disagreement would last for like an hour and a half phone call. And then someone would finally be like, either they would change their mind or they would say, well, I'm just going to write separate. And that was that. Like, then you were just back to joking around.
We'll talk about the dynamics of how those cases are decided. So let's talk about that. So you start on your first day and you get assigned cases. And each case, from what I understand, is then assigned a panel of three judges from your group, right? And it's kind of random. Is that how it is?
Yeah, I don't exactly know because they're looking at everyone's conflicts. But that docketing process, those people, they got a nightmare of a job because I always just assumed it's as easy as a case comes in, electrical case, give it to, but they're checking workloads. So they knew how many of my assigned cases I hadn't finished yet. And so no one's sitting there like with 40 cases on your docket and this guy's got three. So however they did their little magical process, the case gets assigned to you. And so you're either, they list them, the first person listed, I just call them the first judge, whatever. But if it's your case, you're the guy writing it, that's 1/3 of your cases. And then 2/3 of your cases, you're a guy on the panel. You're not writing. So you know what cases you're going to write going in. You can see all the cases, but I, like if you were another judge there, like I don't know your workload. There's no way for me to predict when you're going to get one of these. So whenever I got assigned cases, and you would get them in a bunch. So when I got down to about, like, let's say 5 cases, someone would notice I'd get 10 more. And as soon as I saw them, I immediately looked for conflicts. I didn't want to put anyone in a bad spot where you're ready to do this case. You call me up, and I look at it for the first time, and I'm like, oh, I got a conflict. So I always looked first and would shoot an email off to apparently what. I forget, there was a mailbox you sent it and said, I have a conflict, please add this. And that's what would happen at first is you make up your little conflicts list when you first start. But there's always people, someone you forget, like, oh, I put the whole firm down, but I forgot they left and went to this firm. I don't have a conflict with that firm, but I have a conflict with that person. So you say, add them to the list.
They last like 1 year?
So it was either 1 or 2 years. There were some cases that would last two, the board allowed you to keep a conflict permanent. They actually were great. They never questioned you. If you said you had a conflict, you had a conflict. Like there was no
the judge.
Yeah. So Harity was on my permanent conflict list. I never wanted to do a Harity case or anyone that I knew. Well, I still come in contact with John Harity. And I liked, you know, I came back, but it was like doing a case, like, you know, your brother, but, you know, just didn't feel right, especially if I.
There was a judge who went from App. He was an outside attorney for Apple. Did you hear about that case? He was an outside attorney for Apple.
I knew him a little bit.
Yeah. Then he went to the PTAB, made a bunch of decisions in favor of Apple, and now he got a job in-house at Apple. So,
so my opinion, I knew who he was because of all the big, I mean, hit the blogs, I think a couple times. I know he definitely hit it when he went back to Apple. But I had interacted with him a few times. Like, so for the first 6 months, I had to go into the office before I started teleworking. I saw him a couple times. Not super nice. I never, like, worked with him because he did AIA cases. But my opinion, just completely from kind of hearing talk or whatever, I would say he thought someone at the board, the first time it hit, because I think they were better the second time. But the first time he hit the blogs, PTAP had no response. I think that hurt his feelings pretty good. I don't know, AIA, but so on the ex parte side, I think I would recognize the Herity case because we write in a particular style. I definitely would recognize a Herity app if it was cited as a reference. But I told you, I look for those conflicts like right when the case gets assigned. It could be 2-3 months later, like depending on when someone picks it up. I'm not looking again because I know, like I've already looked. I look when it gets assigned. Like I'm not. So I just call it like I see it. Like I'm not like, ooh, this is so-and-so. Now, I will admit, sometimes a brief was so remarkable that you had to go look and see who that person was. Like, you're like, I need a face. I got to put a face to this. And there was a couple.
And good and bad?
The bad ones were always more fun. Like, you know, you'd just be like, wow, that's something. The ones that would call you names or call the examiner's names. I didn't mind if it kind of slipped out like once or twice in the brief.
Yeah. Like,
but you go on like a 2 or 3 paragraph rant about what an idiot the examiner is. I might have to go look and see who you are because, you know, what are you doing? It ain't going to help you. I don't know. Maybe he is, but I can't.
So let's walk through on the practical basis. You were a judge and how did you make a decision? So what's the first thing that you looked for? Let's say you're assigned case, ex parte appeal, Robertson or whatever.
Yeah, so ahead. I've already done all the conflicts. Like I'm through all the little administrative stuff because there was a couple steps. I looked for like related cases because if it was related to something and some other group of judges had already decided some appeal, I'd email or call and say, hey, do you want this one? Like you've already done this case basically.
So that's interesting. So if you're like, let's say you're appealing to continuations, chances are they're going to end up with the same judge.
Doesn't have to. I did that mostly because I thought it might be easy for this guy. Like he's already kind of invested. And I had him tell me no. Someone would be like, yeah, I'll do it. Like I just did that one like a month ago. Like I still remember. Or someone would be like, if you tell me I did it, I believe you. But that was what, a couple years ago? Like just do it. But I would look. And also the tricky part is, let's say there was a related case. And it's basically the same argument. And you don't agree with the previous decision. What do you do? Like, if that guy didn't take the case back, hey, too bad. I'm going my way.
It'd be unfair. The applicant got twice the wrong decision just because the first one was bad.
Sometimes I tell people, there really was very few close cases. Like I used to sit through the discussions and hear all the people be like, how come there's not more?
All right, let's rewind.
So I did a lot of prosecution. The first thing I do is I go to the claims and I'm reading the independent claim one because everybody argues claim one. Not everybody because there's some people that don't. But general rule, you're going to deal with claim one. And I'm just trying to figure out like what's the invention about. And I am trying, I used to always see if I could spot the limitations that were going to get argued. You know how you do prosecution. So you read through and there's usually, if the claim's got 6 limitations, there's probably 2 that you're like, all right, this is the meat. This is the stuff that you can actually make amendments and do something to. The rest is receiving data, displaying data, whatever. So that's the first thing I'm doing. If I can't understand the invention, which you would be surprised, either there's a lot of jargon and I'm like, those words mean nothing to me, or the claim is just written poorly and you're like, I don't even know if this makes sense. I have no idea what you're doing. Or it's so broad that you're like, this could be 1,000 different things. Then the next thing I'm doing is I'll go to the spec and I'll just read it. I'm going to read it anyways, but assuming I could figure out the invention, I'm then going to scroll through the arguments just so I know, what are you going to argue? Like what?
So do you look at the appeal brief first?
Is that I went to the appeal brief first. That's the first thing I would pull up. So it's all on the computer. So I'm pulling up the appeal brief. There's bookmarks. I hit the claims, read through claim one, scan through the dependents just to see. You can usually tell by looking at the dependents if there's going to be any of them that are argued. That's not true. But I used to think, all right, if you make arguments on these, I have no idea what you're going to argue. But I'd scan through just to see what you got. And sometimes it would help kind of figure out the invention. And then I'm going up to your argument section. And a lot of people use the headers. And so I'm kind of scrolling through that says like the references do not teach cut paste limitation. And then those things normally aren't bookmarked. So it's a PDF file. I'll go through and I'll bookmark where all the arguments are. Start, when I go back later, I can just be clicking on bookmarks. I'm scanning through, seeing what did you argue. Like, it's pretty easy to tell, like, improper combination arguments. What I really wanted to know was, were there any arguments where you say the reference teaches this, it doesn't, it teaches this? Because those are pretty fact-based. Is that what the examiner said? What parts of the reference did he said say? Like, you're going to go research. So I'm scrolling through looking for that. And then once I got just a general idea of what's kind of getting argued, I'll go to the rejection. I'm going to see what the examiner said.
So you're going to an office section at this
point? Office section, yeah. Usually final rejection. Because you get caught once, you'll never get caught again. But just because the appeal brief says the examiner cited to this or said this, that doesn't mean that's what the examiner really said. So, and those are my favorite. If you say the examiner says like paragraph 43 teaches this and it doesn't, and I look down and the examiner didn't even rely on that reference, like he used a different reference, you're not going to win on that. Like, yeah. You got to at least argue whatever. So that's what I'm checking. So I kind of know what you're arguing. What did the examiner say? Because examiners sometimes say something completely different in the appeal brief. You know, I used to open up two screens, or not the appeal brief, the answer. I'm going to compare the final, or the office action and the answer, and see, is he saying the same thing? Or did he read appellant's arguments and be like, eeh, he's probably right, I should have listened to him. And now he's saying something completely different.
And I see that often, that the examiner answer is much stronger than the final office.
I always wondered why. I didn't know. So I know they got a, you look at the bottom, two other people sign off on that answer. And I always wonder, like, did one of them be like, no, like, you better go look, because you hope that's what happened. Like,
yeah. No, yeah. I think there are specialists who help the examiners.
But I know from prosecuting, that's one of the most annoying things where they, for the first time ever, come up with this claim construction, and you're like, now you're saying that changes the whole game. And now you got like your reply brief is like another appeal brief, because it's a completely different ball game. I hated that.
But as a judge, is your impression, do you give the same weight if they have an examiner's answer, or is your impression, well, they seem desperate and scrambling the examiner to put something together? What is your gut telling you when you see something like that? Or
you can tell when the examiner's scrambling, but at the end of the day, for me, it always came down to the reference. If the examiner just is spewing nonsense, but he cited to a good section of the reference, hey, that's an attorney making a lot of money writing that appeal brief. Like, I care what he says. You read the reference and you know, and this is reading on my claim. Like,
right.
I don't care that this guy's spewing nonsense. Like, I want a valid claim. I got to do something. If the appellant didn't do that, so let's assume that the reference is good. Examiner cites a good paragraph. It's word for word reading on your claim limitation. But the examiner's explanation, who knows what that means? So if the appellant's argument is purely just focused on this nonsense that came out in the answer or the office section, and he's hoping you don't read the section of the reference, I don't have a lot of sympathy. I looked, I never could find it, but I always was told, probably the same thing, is that as a practitioner, the examiner cites a reference at you, regardless of what he says, you're responsible to know everything that reference teaches, right? So, you know, the most embarrassing thing in the world is you make an amendment, and yeah, it's not taught by the portion of the reference cited by the examiner, but he comes back at you with the same rejection and just cites to a different paragraph. Like, I hated that. It happens. Some of these references, examiners like to use these huge 99-page references, and
or they do get creative, you know, sometimes in a,
yeah,
they might be right, I guess, on second thought, you know.
Broadest reasonable interpretation, that's a wonderful tool. I know how much fun it can be sometimes to deal with an examiner, but if it's a good reference, it's a good reference. Like, I was never gonna kind of sign my name to some decision unless there's some technicality. But I'm not going to say that the reference doesn't teach a limitation just because the examiner didn't articulate it. If it teaches it, and he cited to it, or that was always a thing. Say he cites the paragraph 17, he cites paragraph 19, and there it is, word for word in paragraph 18. I usually was like, you tell me to skip paragraph 18? That's not my case. I didn't skip paragraph 18. Like, I'm not making attorney money anymore. If I could read paragraph 18. But I'll tell you a story. I probably told you this one. It was an oral hearing. Examiner, let's say, cited a figure four, and the arguments were all based on figure four. And it was good arguments. Like, it was, you can make a strong argument that figure four didn't teach it. Figure eight, though. Like, figure eight could have been taken from the appellant's spec. Like, it was 102. And I remember sitting there, I listened to arguments, and I was like, I gotta say it. Did you consider figure eight? Attorney flips there, and he's like, oh. And you're like, come on, man, at least flip through the figures. Like, but he was right. He said, well, examiner didn't cite to it. And it was different embodiment. So ended up, I think, I don't know if we gave him a new ground or not. Probably. But that was my thing. Like, if it's a good reference, it's a good reference. I'm not gonna ignore what the reference says. I did the same thing on the other side. So if your argument wasn't great, but you made the minimum thing, you said the claim requires this, the reference doesn't teach this, it teaches that, this other thing. If you're right, you're right. I didn't need an essay.
So let's say you have some absurd situation where receiving data from a mobile device, and that's obviously not a new invention, but the examiner's reference does not cite that. Are there situations like that where you're like, you know, this is obvious novelty? And how do you process with that? Let's two different situations. One where the examiner kind of in the argument says, well, of course, data is received from a mobile device. Where else would it come from? Let's say without citing the reference. Another situation is where the examiner doesn't cite some portion of a, cite some reference that does not disclose it. But I guess how, as a judge, how do you deal with situations like that, I guess?
So a lot of that kind of depends on appellant's arguments. If appellant makes the argument, say in either case, if the appellant doesn't make the argument that whatever the examiner did was not sufficient, that's an affirmance because you got to make that argument. At least give me something. But if they do make the argument, you know, if it's not there, it's not there. So like I said, I don't know what other people did, but I know when I really like was like, this is a gift, appellant, I would put in something like, we are constrained by the record to reverse. Yeah. Like, I'm not saying this is patentable. I'm saying the examiner's rejection stinks and it doesn't meet the minimum requirements and appellant gets to win. So you can do new grounds. I always would rather reverse. I know what a pain it is to go through the process and to finally appeal in a case. And all you wanted was the examiner to make a good rejection. So many people are looking at the examiner's work. You know, two people signed off on the answer. That no one caught it, like for these really bad cases, it's reversal. Catch it next time. It ain't on me. I'm not saying it's patentable. I'm saying your rejection stinks. I'm reversing. The process is too hard to open up, reopen prosecution. Not my problem. I didn't make those rules. Do I assume that a panelist is going to get a notice of allowance? That's what I used to get. Like, I mean, because no one wants to go request from whoever got to request that permission for. Because it would make everyone look bad, right? So they just issue a notice of allowance. And they blame it on the board. Oh, the board reversed. Their rejection stunk. How about that? Like, and I'm not, why am I going to re-examine this thing and give them this new ground of rejection? Right. Like, no. He fought with you for 4 years. Like,
the judges aren't going to go do a search, an updated search, Vic. If they're going to do a new grounds, it would have to be kind of a gut kind of thing, right?
I've known people to do a search.
Wow. Okay. From your sense, tell me if that's not the case, because we'll go to the next step. But a typical judge like you, let's say, you're focused on the claim language and the references. And if the examiner does a horrible rejection, but the reference is good, the rejections are going to get affirmed. If the examiner does, he uses a lot of a lot of great reasoning, but the references don't reflect what he's arguing, then it might get reversed. That's kind of
it's probably gonna get reversed. The better the appellant's arguments were, that a bad rejection makes them so much more persuasive, right? Like, that's just common sense. Like, it's the ones where they're basically saying rejection stinks. The reference doesn't teach it. You should just look at that and know it. You're like, I'm not gonna look at it and know it. Do your job. Like,
so let's talk about it. Like, what makes for a good argument? So let's say, you know, often a situation happens during prosecution where an examiner cites a paragraph, let's say of a reference, and you look at that paragraph and you're like, I have no idea how the examiner is mapping whatever's in that paragraph to what's in our claim. So what would be a good argument, I guess, when you're appealing that?
So I like everyone has this little whatever format they like to use, but right out the gate, in plain English, tell me what your argument is. So in that case, you know, you would use your polite attorney words, but basically, examiner cites this paragraph, have no idea how he is mapping. And down below, I'm going to go through all the possible ways that I think he could be mapping it. None of them worked. But before you get lost in all that minutia, here's my main point. It doesn't map out. Don't hide it.
So that's actually a good advice, because when you're arguing with the examiner, you're kind of trying to give him every benefit of a doubt when you're an applicant. You're like, even assuming this is to this and this is to that. But when you're with the board, you have to kind of take a different posture and be
direct. Like, you can do that down below, but you know, sometimes like there's like three or four different possible ways. You risk losing the reader. So right out the start, the ones I always kind of found really persuasive, maybe they were wrong, but was the ones where right out the start, you knew exactly what he was going to tell you. Like, here's my punch. He's saying these paragraphs teach this limitation. I am going to go through all the different possible ways I think he might be mapping this, but it's unclear. I have no idea what he's doing. But just so you know, none of them work. Read the rest if you want. That's my point. So for me, that's great, because I'm going to catch it during my initial review. And now when I'm looking at the office action and the answer, like, I know I need to try and figure out how he's mapping this, because that's, and you know, the mapping thing is so funny, because that, man, those are nightmares. Like, most of the time, appellants are right. They may not say it very clearly in the brief, but that just what you're saying, like, I have no idea what he's doing. And we had that one examiner, like, here's your, I'm going to cite to 50 pages, give you no explanation. But those are hard, because when you're briefing that case, you got to walk. So if you're the one writing it, you're leading the discussion. Everyone else has read up on it, but it's your presentation. And it eventually will kind of boil down into like a conversation, but it always starts out as a, today class, we're going to talk about case number, whatever. And then once you finally get into the meat, then you have your real talk. But during your little conference, you're actually going to walk through all those possible mappings. And maybe if you thought of some others that the examiner might have, you got to walk through those and see if any of them work. And then it's nice when it's so bad and you can just stop and be like, this is a reversal. I have no idea what he's saying. I can't possibly think of a way this section is going to map onto this claim. If you get at least one of the other two to agree with you, that's an easy case to write up. The key to remember, like you say to new judges, you'd always ask, did appellant make that argument? You got to make that argument. And you might think that you made that argument, but you would be amazed the number of times where you read through 10 pages and you're like, there's no argument here. Nowhere does it say the claim requires this. The reference does not teach this. It teaches this. Usually it's just cut and paste from the reference and not even skimming a bone. At the bottom of it, be like, the stuff I just cut and paste above is not insert claim limitation. Like, you can't reverse if you can't honestly say as you're writing the decision, appellant argued this. We agree. I know you think to yourself, like, well, that's not, like, never happens. Happens a lot. That's a lot, but it should never happen. I should be talking about the one guy I knew that had a case like that. But, you know, if you do 50 cases, you get it at least once. And it's a shame, especially when it's not a good reference.
Yeah. So that's really good advice in terms of, even if the examiner's position is bad, if you don't make the arguments that allow the reversal to happen, doesn't mean you're going to win.
Yeah. And say it in plain English, like, don't risk the people on that panel not being able to understand what you're saying. You don't get any points for fancy language. You get docked if it's not clear. And you can usually tell in the decision. So I used to write stuff like, appellants appear to argue or seem to argue, like, without me saying something that some client's going to read and be like, oh, my attorney stunk. Like, I'm trying to say, I didn't really get what you're saying. Here's what I think. If I got it wrong, file a request for a hearing and tell me what those words meant. I'll reconsider it. Like, I know we've had this conversation before. Like, nobody gets upset that you filed a request for a hearing, especially if it's legitimate. Like, you're not just doing it.
So just to explain, so the request, for some people not familiar with the process, so after the PTAB issues a decision, ex parte appeal, the applicant, I guess, can file a request for a rehearing with the same panel.
Yes, and you have to cite to basically a mistake. I think that's like an argument that was misunderstood, a new case coming out. So when the new 101 guidance came out from the director, we got a bunch of requests for a hearing, all the cases that were that kind of got issued before that, which was a lot because we knew the new guidance was coming out. We didn't know how to analyze cases yet. Like, who knew? There was rumors about what it was going to be like, but you didn't know. So you're like, I'm getting rid of all my 101 cases. And then they all come back. Oh, please review under the new guidance. Oh, thanks. So misunderstanding. There's language. So misunderstood an argument, made a mistake. You can't make a new argument unless it's for new grounds of rejection, you could. But there's no negative connotation with that. It goes right back to the same panel. I can tell you, at least my experience, I don't want to make a mistake. That was the funniest thing about being at the board is before I got there, I would have bet money. Nobody cared. Just chuck these things out. 5 o'clock, time to go home. Who cares? They really care. Like, they want to get it right. And it was it caught me completely by surprise. And especially, like, if I'm just on the panel, I'm not the one writing it, I'm not letting you blow it off.
Yeah, so let's go through that process. So you make your decision. You're doing on the lat analysis. You're looking at the appeal brief, reply brief, examiner's answer. You come to decision. And then at that point, you contact the other two judges on the panel and say, I want to discuss this case. Are you always having an oral discussion about each case?
Everybody's allowed to do it their own way. So usually you get a meeting invite. Hey, if this doesn't work for you, suggest a new one. Some people will put a little summary in the meeting invite. I never did.
So usually the judges, do they tell you, let's say you're judge one and that's the main judge. You're saying most of the time, do they tell you what their decision is before you look at it? No. Everybody kind of comes to that meeting independently.
Yeah, so everyone looks at it on their own.
So at that point, you haven't written the decision yet because you're going to wait for the...
I've got a good skeleton up. So I don't know what other people did, but for me, as I'm going through the case, it was just easy to kind of set up my little sections, throw in the claim that's going to get argued, like in the top part, fill in all the administrative stuff. But I didn't write it because you don't know. Like, just because you think it's going to be one way, you could be wrong or you can miss something. But you go in and you start out just walking them through. You can do it however you want. I learned from this guy, Judge John O'Meara. Awesome. Very smart. He was very meticulous about how he briefed cases. Always did it the same way. And it was so easy to understand. He walked you through it. And his big thing was he would find a figure, either in your spec and the reference. And the first thing he did to you was describe the invention. Here's what we're going to talk about. Here's all the pieces. And then you would pull up claim one. assuming that's what got argued, I would walk them through the claim, referring back to the figures, right? So now when I'm done with that, of course, everyone's already looked at it, but if you didn't, I briefed it like you hadn't looked at it. So everyone understands what the invention is, what's in the claim, and then I'll point out, here's the limitations that got argued. And then you just, that's when it starts to become a real discussion. Because usually the first question is, well, what'd they argue?
So at that point, judges 2 and 3, let's call them, they haven't really delved into the arguments yet. Or if you're not the main judge on a case, or it varies, I guess it's up to
you. Yeah, it's up to, some people looked. So you can ignore number 3. So let's say it's me, you, and some other person. And you and I agree. It's worst case, 2-1. I got to talk to him. I'm not even going to tell you what I write. I'm going to write up a draft. You can see what I wrote when you read it. Either sign off on it or write your own. Like, you could just abuse number 3 if you want. People don't abuse anyone, but it just all depends on who the judges are and who wants. So there's people that'll say, if I'm number 3, don't bother me unless you 2 can't agree.
Oh, so when you have a discussion, sometimes you're actually 2 or 3. So the 2 and 3 do play different roles in a sense.
It just depends on the judges. It really is personality. Like, so let's say it's me, you, and Paul Gerzo. Like, we know each other, right? So say you're trying to finish up a case of your own, and I want to have this thing, and you're number 3. Number 2 can't ever back out. He's number 2. He's in the discussion. But number 3 can say, you guys have to help me. Like, yeah. Call me if there's an issue. Like, if I got to be the deciding vote, a lot of cases aren't close. And so why are you going to bother number 3? Like, he can't. For the close ones, all 3 usually. I mean, there's definitely been ones where, I mean, it's like a week of going back and forth with people. Because you'll come to some disagreement. And you basically walk away, right? People will be like, I'm writing separate. And then people start thinking, and they'll ask a question, maybe shoot an email or something, and call you up. And now you're going, or let's say I think it's a reversal, and you don't agree at all, and you're going to write separate. But let's say there's like 3 arguments, and all we got to was the first argument, because I want to reverse. So I didn't even look at the other 2. I think it's a reversal. I could stop here. All I got to do is convince 1 more person that it's a reversal, like, and I'm done. But me and you can't agree. And so you're going to write separate. And you start kind of thinking about it. And you're like, you know what? I think you're wrong about this first argument. But let's talk about the second argument. I can agree that the second argument is a reversal. And you're like, well, that's fine. You only need 1. And so you can avoid anyone writing separate, or you don't even talk about the first argument. You know, and you're just like, all right, we all agree that the second argument, appellants are right. And so it's an easy way. It limits the amount of times like that you're going to have a dissent or whatever. Because usually when the examiner does a bad job, he does a really bad job. Like, there's not just 1
issue.
Yeah. And it was pretty easy to find things that people could agree on, or they want it worded a certain way. We're not going to say the reference doesn't teach it. We're going to say the reference basically didn't find that the reference taught it. You know, he didn't establish the prima facie case, whatever. So many ways to kind of work it around. 101 was pretty, you weren't getting people to change their minds. Like, it's just one of those opinionated little areas. The new guidance made it easier, because now there was a way to say, it does this, we can reverse. Before that guidance, almost every case, I could find you a case that was probably close enough to reverse. I could find you another case that was probably close enough to affirm. Like, there was cases all over the place. Like, you could do whatever you wanted. And the rejections were getting bad. Everything was, it's just obtaining data, analyzing data, generating a result of the analysis. Everything. That's all you were saying. And you're like, that's every computer invention ever, because at the end of the day, that's all the computer's doing. It's obtaining data, it's analyzing data, it's generating some result. And then you're going to call any other step, like insignificant post-solution activity or whatever. Come on, I could use that reasoning to reject any claim out there. And you see it, the blogs, people did it all the time. Like, MRI machine? You're like, yeah, those are just extraneous components. You're like, whoa.
There was some garage door opener case. I haven't delved into that one.
I haven't read it, but yeah, I was reading the little clips about it. And you're like, man, when they're starting to be things that you can physically put your hands on. I know there's case law because I'm saying we can ignore all that, but it didn't feel right. So I was on that side of the fence. Like, if you got some physical hardware in there, and it's not just a processor, but, you know, you take the MRI machine or the garage door opener, there's a thing. I could go to the store and I could buy this thing, and it's going to do this function that you're claiming, regardless of what the case law said, you know, the guidance, whatever. In my mind, I was always like, feels pretty patentable. That's a real thing. But you had judges on the other side that were like, data in, data out, 101. You're like, that's not. And so when two of those collided, there was no agreement. Someone was right and separate.
Let's talk about now. So it's funny because I was going to talk about 101. You were talking about the revised guidance. You know, once those came into place, the judges' analysis become more uniform, or was there still that division between judges who were, and how did those guidance get implemented? Like, did your lead judge say, okay, everybody has to kind of?
We sat down as a the board. We had a, you know, one of these video calls or whatever, and they had already emailed it out, but we went through it. There was like a presentation. Judge Kim walked us through it, and we could ask questions, and everybody knew, like, it's not up for discussion. We're not here to talk about do we like this or not. If you have questions, you are now required to implement this. If you have questions about how that's done, we did. Because it was brand new. Like, but once I got comfortable and kind of understood it, and it took a while, probably took 7-8 cases where you're like, you really were like, oh, I get it. Yeah, I was walking through the steps, but I didn't have that great comfort. But I finally kind of got it, and I'm like, oh, it does marry up like with the case law. The biggest thing it did was it kept that whole data in, data out, 101 rejection out of play, which was killing everybody. Nobody liked that. But examiners liked it because that was pretty easy. But the rest, if you were going to reverse pre-guidance, you were definitely going to reverse post-guidance. The only thing that happened is there were some cases that you might have affirmed pre-guidance that you now couldn't. But it gave me something during the conference, like, because it walked through, like, and you could say, nope, this improves the functioning of the computer. Right here. It says it right in the spec that now using less memory.
We don't have time to dive into those guys.
Sorry.
No. I think this is great because I was going to actually ask you. So you have that guy, you have like step 2A. The revised guys really introduced this concept of step 2A, prong 1 and prong 2. Prong 1 is whether it recites an abstract idea and they give very defined groupings. And step 2A, prong 2 is whether it integrates an idea into a practical application. So even though it might recite an abstract idea, if it integrates it into a practical application, which is an improvement to computer, for example, then it should still be patentable under 101. And let me know if you disagree with my quick summary. But I guess, what arguments did you see for 101 that you found most effective? Was it under one of those prongs?
No, because that first prong, does it recite an abstract idea? That's pretty broad. That's anywhere in the claim. So if you have a receiving data step, you're reciting an abstract idea. And we got to go to the next step.
It doesn't matter if the examiner, or once again, even if the examiner did a bad job of...
Yeah, 101, we just, especially once the guidance came out, because the examiner didn't have the guidance. But even so, it was so case law specific, and the examiner may be an attorney, but most of them are not.
Yeah.
So it was hard to be like, oh, how did you not analyze this case? We walked through it pretty good. He had to hit before the guidance, like, he had to tell me what the abstract idea was. Like, he had to hit the big tickets. Yeah. I could walk through the steps. But that first one, does it recite an abstract idea? That usually was pretty easy. The thing is, all those steps of recite an abstract idea, let's say now you take them out of the claim. So when you go to the next step, they're out. Now you're looking at the steps that don't recite an abstract idea. And the guidance had basically like lists. Here's when you can kind of discount those steps. extraneous post-solution activity because you're just displaying a result. But in your discussions, I would say all the time, like, so I want to affirm. I'm like, tell me what I do with this step here. Let's go through the list. And don't tell me about some other case that you know of, because I ain't got that available anymore. I got this list. Is it this? Nope. Is it this? Nope. We got to reverse.
And most judges really, I guess that's another question. Should you, as an applicant, should your arguments focus on the guidance, or should you be, let's say the examiner cites some case. I mean, what's the best kind of approach?
You got to do both, because at the end of the day, bad part about the guidance is the courts aren't following it, right? So yeah, Penhall's granted you a bet. And we used a new guidance and we said, this met the requirements of section 101. And that district court, they're going to use old data in, data out, analyzing data, like, and throw you right out of there. Just because I couldn't do it, that doesn't mean Ms. Penn's going to make it past some litigation thing. So you got to be careful of both. But for us, and I knew what the director was trying to do. Like, there was no order. Like, people were doing whatever they want with 101. Like, here's what I think the case says. And the cases were all over the place. So it was what
exactly case. That's kind of the issue.
He roped everyone in and said, we didn't cover every scenario because it's impossible. There's some contradictions or whatever. We got like a 90% solution. And now everyone's doing the same thing and it's workable. Like, you can actually have a discussion about, does this improve the computer? Like, you know, does it make it faster? And you can, for the appellant's sake, so I never got a case, you know, there's that delay, but where someone made arguments under the new guidance. But I could see right away, there's arguments to be made, especially for some of these, you know, encoding data type inventions, right, which you're not doing that by hand. I can say that it's possible to do that by hand, but you and I both know we're not doing those competitions, you know, computations by hand. Like, that's what, 3 years of doing all this stuff. But I liked it. It helped the conference because I could make you explain to me how you thought it didn't meet the guidance, or, you know, I had rules now. And before, all I had was case law. And like I said, I had two Word documents. One was my affirmance, 101 affirmance document. The other was my 101 rejection or reversal document. And I just would stick case law, and I had them blocked out by either different arguments or whatever. And I could tell you most of the arguments, which one you want. Like, I can get you a case over here and get you a case over here. I always thought, and people tell me why I'm wrong all the time, but do the 102, 103 first. Once you have allowable claims, like, you know what the claim is going to recite, then look at 101.
You're talking about from perspective of the judge?
Yeah. Well, just even the examiners. Like, we're applying 101 to claims that haven't been allowed. Like, so there's still potentially amendments that are going to be made. So we're just wasting our time. Like, get to a final form of the claim. Deal with 102, 103 first. Once you say, hey, if I don't think about 101, and I just think about like 102, 103, 112, whatever, these claims are patentable. No more amendments are going to be made to get over the art. Then look at 101. And most of these inventions, like the business methods that we're just getting just tore up, they're not making it under 103.
Right.
Right. So you don't ever have to have the 101 discussion. And just the opposite was happening. The examiner knew for a fact this case was never getting by 101. And he wouldn't even do an art-based rejection.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's claims otherwise be allowable. And you're like, yeah, right. I mean, you can't tell me in the 101 that this is a well-known fundamental economic practice. So obviously people have been doing it for years. And then tell me there's no art. That doesn't even make sense. Like, whatever book you got to tell you that this is some fundamental economic practice, that's at least a 103, right? But I like the guidance. I didn't like doing 101 cases because they're really long and hard to write up.
But you were telling me that some judges actually could choose to only handle cases with 101, right?
Yes. So in the electrical group, there were so many 101 cases that the electrical group, we would get them. And if you wanted, you could volunteer to just do 101 cases. There was that many. So I know people that decided, I like
this. And do you know why those people were attracted to those cases?
I have no idea, because I was glad for them. They were like, I would never say a bad word about those people because I didn't want them. Like, the conference usually didn't take very long. The write up, I mean, it's an, man, appellants are making 30 arguments. None of them good. Like, you know, all you did was line these people up by height. And then you're going to have them walk in the classroom and take their picture taken. No, we're dying here under 101. But you're still going to make like 30 arguments. Oh, they're like the claims in, was it McRow? I forget all this. But, you know, everyone makes the same arguments. Like, I don't know what class everyone went to, but there's, now I had them all written down, let's say 12 arguments. Everybody makes them. They're the same. Somebody got them from somewhere and they shared them around. But you still got to write it up. And yeah. So you're at page 40 and you're like, golly, can I reverse this thing? Like, because reverse will be like one page.
Yeah. So it's something else you mentioned to me, when that guidance came out, the decisions were being reviewed by elite judges. Was that just for one-on-one cases, or is that something that happens?
Just one-on-one. It was mostly like an administrative kind of review. Like, they knew that it was going to take a while for people to get their hands around the guidance. So they have these smart people. Once your decision was all done, they would read through it and make sure what you said about the guidance was accurate.
Okay. Oh, so that's what it was. So it's not like we wouldn't come back to you and say, well, you shouldn't have affirmed it. It's like,
no, oh no. I don't think they cared
what your decision was.
It was
accurately characterizing the guidance.
Yeah. And, not saying something that was contrary to the guidance. But then once you did, at some point, they would tell you, you don't need to send them to us anymore.
Okay, so it wasn't like...
And if you want to.
Right. So going back to one-on-one, because obviously that's something that appealing is, people always think about it when they do have a one-on-one rejection. So it seems if you have technical subject matter and you can make a case under step 2A, prong 2, where you have some improvement to the computer or something like that, you'll probably get a one-on-one reverse. What about when you don't have technical subject matter? And I think me and you talked about it. Let's say your case is clearly about advertising or lining up students for taking a picture, like you said, and there's some creative thing in the spec that's thrown out. I guess, how do judges treat that? Is like a method for advertising that improves the computer? You're laughing. I see.
Yeah,
laughing,
you're so screwed. You know, especially after 6 months of doing these one-on-one cases, like, you're pretty smart about, like, and the kind of advantage that the electrical people had probably over, like, the business method judges was, oh, you're saying it improved the computer? Come on. Like, how? No, it didn't. Like, oh, it transmitted less data. There was less data to transmit. Like, did it do it? You can't just blow smoke. You got to make a real argument. But it doesn't have to be like the easiest one. Who knows what people do now? But a lot of times, so the whole, there's less data. Like, data needs to be stored in memory. So instead of saying like, oh, we're transmitting less data, tell me how you're conserving memory. Like, that's an honest to goodness improvement to a computer. And if in the spec you threw in a line about how expensive memory is and how chip space is important, you know, that's significant. Now you got a good argument. The problem is most of the specs were written before 101 became a big deal.
Before Alice, yeah.
They don't have anything. You know, I had done cases that they don't even mention a processor, like nowhere in the spec. Like, it is pure, I call it business, but steps that you could have performed by hand, mentally, whatever it was. And I always read the spec. I just liked it. There's nothing here. Like, you're not saving this case. Like, yeah, it's a shame you drafted it before 101 blew up on everybody, but you got nothing. But you need to put in like a real honest to goodness improvement, like somehow. And we joke about all the time, you got to stay out of the 3600 group. Like, I don't know what their 101 rejection rate is, but I know it's not good.
Yeah, but it seems like even the judges who handled 3600 cases are more skeptical and harder to kind of...
Yeah, there's words that will set people off. I know if you're talking about advertising, you're talking about loyalty financial rewards modeling programs or whatever. That's a tough conversation to have with someone to say you want to reverse, because those concepts have been obliterated by the Federal Circuit.
Yeah, I think that's important to keep in mind, obviously, when you're drafting an application, but also when you think that the board is going to be your savior. It's probably not the case.
Amend the claim and get that word out of there. Like, there's so many other words you can use besides advertise. Like, just information. That's better than the advertising. But I would guess, based on the number of cases, that if your case gets assigned to 3,600 and you don't want to abandon it, you're probably going to appeal. Because it seemed like, and I don't know what they're doing now with the new guidance. And it could just be that I saw it, but we joke about all the time. Like, that's the place where some patents or some applications go to die. Like,
yeah.
What are they? They're like the business method group. So if there ever was some subject matter area that was inherently doomed by 101, it would be the business method stuff. Just the name of it.
And the judges know that, right? So they.
Yeah. And like I said, most of those, I don't know the history. We had the judge write a big 101 paper, the Patent Office Journal. I forget what it's called. And it was a good paper. He went through the whole history of 101. I read it. And I do know there was a period of time where there was a belief that taking these business methods and doing them with a computer was probably patentable. So you get a flood of those cases. And then before they could issue, no. There's nothing you can do. I wasn't practicing them, but I imagine when that case changed means plus function. So at some point, people believe means plus function was the broadest way to claim something. So here you've drafted your patent application, filed it, you're prosecuting it, and it's got all this means plus function stuff. You get a patent. A month later, that case comes out saying, like, that's the most narrow way, and you better have, like, hardware in there. What do? You're just screwed. Same thing with 101. Like, if you didn't put it in there before you filed it, what are you going to do now? Nothing. Like, and so we would see those cases, and you feel bad, and they make the best arguments you can make, but they're, you figured out the user's location, saw he was near the store, and you sent him an ad. No, that ain't working. Like, unless you got something in there about how you figured out the user location.
Yeah.
Maybe. But you don't. You even put in your spec. That's well known. And you're like, oh, now you're screwed. The one piece of technology you got, instead of taking the time to describe it, you admit it's well known. Well, I'm weeding that out during one of those final prongs, right?
And that's good advice, obviously. So you're putting the 101 aside. There's a school of thought. I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the appeal brief, just for hopefully we're getting in. There's a school of thought, well, you know, the PTAB judges are attorneys, lawyers. You should really not be filing the same kind of arguments you would present to, and we talked a little bit about it, to an examiner. You should be making legal arguments. Putting the 101 aside, can you talk about, I guess, your thoughts about that? Have you seen that be effective or persuasive in appeal briefs? Or is it really like we were talking about in the beginning, you really should be just focusing on the art and the claims?
For ex parte, it's all about the art and the claims. Because, you know, there's always some case where some weird thing and you actually could make some case law based argument, right? But for the most part, it comes down to, is it obvious to combine these references? Does the reference teach it? Now, I do know on the AIA side, I mean, it's all case law based, which I can be flippant, I guess, but I did use a joke with my friends that did AIA and be like, you're lucky us ex parte guys don't get over there, because all you're doing is what we do. Like, and I can read a reference, look at the claims, and I got a pretty good guess whether it's a 102, 103. Yeah. Like, I don't need some subject matter expert guy to come in at $1,200 an hour.
Yeah.
Tell me what a processor is. I know what a processor is.
Like, yeah.
I know what it does. Oh, you want to join people? Join them up. Is the art good or not? Like, you're paying all this money. But on the ex parte side, okay, so besides 101, like 102, 103, everybody knows the case law. It's not, hasn't been real significant changes since what KSR, I guess, but a lot of the arguments are the examiner says this teaches my component X. It doesn't. And so what does the examiner do? Broadest reasonable interpretation? Yes, it does. And sometimes the appellant can explain why that's not reasonable. A lot of times the spec kind of kills them. That was the most annoying thing. Don't tell me they're not the same thing. When I read in your spec, that thing is listed as one of the examples, like that your recited thing might be. Read your spec. And you know from drafting apps, when I'm describing something, I'm throwing in every possible thing I can think of. And so a lot of times the spec makes examiner's interpretation kind of reasonable.
So it's important not to only know what the reference says, but also what your own specification says.
It's an easy way, because you don't want to go look up some technical dictionary and like, I don't know if these are the same thing. Like, I never even heard of that before. Now I got this other reference. Usually, if it's some weird term, the reference cited, like they're the same company, like, you know, whoever, because they're the only people in the world that use that term. So the examiner just word searched, found it in another one of your references. Yeah, so instead of doing, before I do all that research, figuring out, is it reasonable to say, I look in the spec and I'm like, what'd you say it was? Oh, there it is. I'm done. I'll summarize your arguments for you and I'll be like, not persuasive because you said it could be that and we're out of here. So I know sometimes clients say appeal and you're stuck. Like you're making the best argument. So I never took it. Oh, this guy stinks. Like, did he not read a spec? He made the best argument he could. Like, sometimes clients like, I want that claim. And you're like, I'm not going to get you that claim, but give it a shot. Like, you know, and you're doing the best you can and trying to find the most reasonable, straight-faced argument. It's just not good.
What about, like, are there any other things that you saw, good or bad, in appeal briefs where it was, like, creative? Like, you know, they tried to kind of tell you a story or, you know, say what a grave injustice has been done or something like that. You gave an example about, you know, obviously people badgering examiners is bad. But anything that you saw maybe that was good, that was like, we had a 3-year-long struggle of, I don't know.
It was definitely like people going through the litany of abuses, like they have suffered from this examiner. This is the fourth time I've written this appeal brief.
Yeah.
He keeps reopening prosecution and he still hasn't addressed the one argument that I'm making. And you're like, been there. And then most of the time, the attorney's right on those. Like the ones that tend to get creative usually are doing it because they don't have an argument to make. So they try and just throw as many words at you as they can. I don't even remember the guy's name, but he did an oral hearing. And that's when I learned the value of an oral hearing. And it was a printer, I think. But he had a very technical argument about why you could not combine these two references. He even started out the oral hearing with, I don't know if it comes across in the brief. I did the best I can. The best way I can show you is walking you through these different figures. He was like, they finally got you the parts. He goes, see, if you try and put these parts together, this isn't going to line up with this. This thing's not going to let this happen. And he's like, it's mechanically not possible. This thing is doing the opposite of what it should be doing if it's positioned over here. And I can't remember his name, but I was on the panel with an old guy. He had started like in the patent office, like in the 40s, 50s, like been there forever. My first oral hearing, and he leaves and he says, never in all the years have I ever done this, have I ever had an appellant make an argument that was good enough to change my mind.
Yeah.
I didn't understand how many people come to that thing unprepared, but he convinced me. Like, I think it's a reversal. And I was like, that's good, because I was nervous about disagreeing with you when you've been here forever and you're old. Like, right? No, but yeah, so that I like the oral hearings. If you think it's helpful to talk someone through it and let them, because, you know, they'll ask you questions. Like, I don't get what you just said. What you're saying, this can't, why can't that go there? Like, you're not adding arguments or changing the argument in your brief. You're letting me ask the questions that I'm going to ask anyways, but instead of asking you could probably give me the answer. I'm going to ask another judge and we're going to guess. Like, is he saying these don't match up because of this? But the best briefs ever are straightforward, well-organized. The more work I got to do figuring out what you're arguing, or you're jumping from argument to argument, or bad cut and paste jobs. Like, I don't know how many times the next paragraph you're like, what is this? It's from a different case. Like, they just didn't cut and paste very well. But the ones I always liked, and there was, you'd see it every once in a while, right up front, tell me in plain English, this is my argument, this is why I'm right. If I can't explain that to you using regular words in 30 seconds, you need to think about whether you're really right or not. Because the easiest way for me to convey it is face-to-face, like to you orally. And if I can't do it, do you think I got better because I wrote it on paper? They're not hard, you know, it's prosecution, 102, 103. There's, you know, the other ones, but those are the big ones. You can't tell me why it's not obvious, like in five words or less. Like, I'm not actually asking you to prove it to me. Just tell me why it's not obvious. Like, what's the basis of your argument? Like, the improper combination. Why is it improper? Non-analogous art. Like, okay, now I get it. Now I know exactly where you're going to argue. Explain it to me down below, but right up front, tell me. Like, don't hide it.
My takeaway from all that is, if you're filling up your appeal brief with all this stuff that's not really relevant to what the claims say or what the prior art is about, you're telling some story about how great this invention is. You're telling about why the examination process wasn't fair. The signal you're sending to the judges is you probably have a weak argument. That's why you're not focusing. That's why you're focusing on all this other stuff.
And that's not always the case, but it's easy to assume that. The other thing is, and it's wrong, and I tried not to ever think this way, but every time I didn't see a reply brief, my initial gut reaction, without even being able to control it, you gave up. You think the examiner's right in the answer. There's one firm out there, they will file one piece of paper that says, we don't think he said anything new, so we're standing by it. But it was like their way of saying, we didn't, hey, someone may have told them, like, I don't know what kind of impression it gives not to have a reply brief. But the other weird thing is, you know as well as I do, how often the examiner changes what he's talking about in the answer. So if he's citing a new paragraph, you got to do something.
So that's another signal you're sending. Another takeaway going back. So the process is you file your appeal brief, examiner files his examiner's answer. Then you have an option to file a reply brief. And you have an option to request an oral hearing. And hearing what you're saying is, if you do have some things to make some fine points, it's better to do that through an oral hearing. Really gives you a chance to kind of do that.
I'm surprised more don't do it. But I'll tell you this. If you're not going to show up prepared and you're just going to wing it, don't do it. That'll hurt you. And don't say anything dumb. Probably be obvious. Like, don't say that. I don't want to hear that. Like...
Yeah, oral hearings can hurt you as well. So it's like you got to strategize when they do make sense and they don't.
They are, and there's nothing to be like nervous about. Like, you know, I've never been in court, so I don't know what that's like. But at the end of the day, the three people on the panel are ultra prepared. I don't know what it is, but the fact that you're doing an oral hearing ramps everyone up. And so when you get assigned as a judge, you're going to do six cases in one day. They're like, well, we got you doing it. So you'll do two as number one, two as number two, two as number three. So you have spent at least the entire day before on a call with those other two, and you're walking through every case in the nitty-gritty detail.
Oh, so the judges actually discuss them before the oral hearing?
Yep. So we discuss all the arguments that are made in the appeal brief, and then what I would do is I would then say, this is what I would argue. If I'm the appellant, this is where I think he's going to focus. Like, it's the meat, it's the majority of his brief. Yeah, he makes this argument down here about this dependent claim, but it's like a paragraph. He could throw it in at the end, but I think he's focused on this argument. And then we will go through and we'll write out questions. Like, the examiner says this, you know, why is he wrong? Kind of take the devil's advocate. Like, why isn't it that? Like, tell me. And if you can make those arguments, you know, in your own way, you talk and be like, if you can make this argument, that's a reversal. if you make this one, that's like, so you know kind of what appellant has to do to get a reversal out of you.
That's interesting. So is it like the judges look at those cases differently than they would?
It's just because you're on the stage. I don't know what it is, but man, it's like the Super Bowl. Like you are focused because nobody wants to look bad. And we assume the appellant's going to come in there really prepared and that he's going to know everything in the reference, everything in the spec. And we've got to be just as prepared so we can actually engage him or her in a discussion. That's rarely the case. They'll wear you out. Like it's like the Super Bowl. But it's not, it's just an oral hearing. But when we're done, I am done for the day. Like I have hyper-focused for everyone. I've listened to every word said. I'm checking what does the reference say, even though I've read it 3-4 times, because also there's this transcript, like some little, whatever they call it, court reporter person typing it out. And you're like, I don't want to look stupid on that. People read that thing. Like one guy, he probably was the most prepared person I ever saw come in there. And he was right. He didn't need to do oral hearing. Like this was reverse. It was one of those where like, we didn't really have to discuss that case. Cause you're like, what's the examiner to him? Like it was one of those, as long as you don't say anything dumb. So he makes his argument in about 5 minutes and he wants to keep going. And it was my case. So I had to write it. I want to write the reversal. Like that's an easy write up. And I'm like, so what you're saying, this teaches that, and that's not this. Yes. I think we're good here.
You wouldn't take a yes for an answer.
I'm like, I think we're good. Like, I see, I tend to agree with you. You know, you're coming out and be like, buddy, all you can do is hurt yourself. Keep talking if you want. But you wish there was like the secret sign where you can be like, you need to stop now and we can all go home happy. Because people joke, they think you want to like affirm or whatever. And I know I told you, an affirm is just 10 times harder to write up than a reversal. Like reversal's easy.
But can't, for an affirmance, you just say what the examiner, because the examiner hasn't
laid out the position. I've got to talk about every argument you've made in the appeal brief.
I see.
So you make 10 arguments for 10 different claims. I got to address every one of them. Where if I can reverse on an independent claim, on a limitation that's recited in every independent claim, I can get out of there in a page. Like, appellants argued, reference doesn't teach this. The examiner finds this. We agree that is on this. We reverse. This covers everything. We're not talking about anything else. Bye-bye. Have a good night. Give me my count.
You know, there's a lot to talk about. We could talk about the incentive structure, what me and you talked about, the not using the kitchen sink approach, really focusing on your best arguments. But I guess I want to, you know, end this with kind of asking for your last bit of wisdom, going back to where we started. So you're prosecuting a case and you're trying to decide whether this is a good case to appeal. What's the advice you'd provide about how to kind of think about that?
So I would go to somebody like, so here at Harity, I go to like you. And if I could explain to you in under 5 minutes why the examiner's wrong, and you believe me, I appeal. If you can't do it, if it takes me forever to make this explanation, and at the end of the day, you're like, yeah, I see your point. Yes, it might work for you. Like, you never know what three people are going to do. But that would be my thing. If I can't tell you, like, in, I don't know where I ever got 30 seconds from, but one paragraph, in one written paragraph, I can't say, here's my argument. This is the basis of why I'm right. As I'm going to explain below, you're probably not right. Or you haven't figured out how to say it in a way that someone's going to understand it. The other thing is, like, it's so much easier to hash these out with the examiner over the phone. I would always try that first. There's a lot of reasonable examiners out there. And if you can't convince him, but if you think someone's not going to read it at the board, if you think they're not going to read the references or your spec, because, you know, we've all gotten those decisions for the reasons stated by the examiner, we affirm, one page, thank you, have a nice day. No matter what that decision, how short or sparse that may be, I'm telling you, those conferences are tough. Nobody lets you slide. They're attorneys. Like, and since they don't have to write it, they don't care. And they're not putting their name. That's the other thing. Even if you write it, it don't go out the door until everyone signs it. They don't let you half step. So don't think you're going to pull one. You may get lucky. You may pull one over on somebody, catch them on a bad day, whatever. But there's two other people that have no skin in the game on that panel. It's not their case. So no one's going to ask them, how come it's not done yet? They're not getting any counts for it either way. You only get counts for the ones you write. And they're not writing it. They don't care. They just want it right. Whatever the right answer is, that's what they want. And they will wring it out of you if they got to. No one lets you slack. So don't think they're going to. They got all the time in the world. AA's got that 1-year deadline. Like, you might be able to pressure them into something.
Yeah.
Next party. You know, that thing could sit there for years. Who cares? And they're smart. People have been examiners there for years, and then they moved up to the board. They have seen every argument. So if you can't tell a friend or a coworker short and simple why you're right, probably not gonna win. And we're good with technicalities. Before you say to make a prima facie case, go look at that N. Ray Young and see how easy it is to make a prima facie case, and then rethink that argument. But he missed the limitation. He missed the limitation. You're going to win. We're happy for you. That's easy to write up. Like, that's the thing. I think people think, like, people there are, like, against the appellants. One, I don't think anyone cares. We don't really talk about, oh, how many did you reverse today? I don't even know what my percentage was. But I do know it's easier to write a reversal. They're shorter. They're simple. It's not getting appealed to the Federal Circuit. There ain't no one coming and checking behind your back on that one. Everyone loves those. Like, yay, reversal. So if you got a good argument, you got a technicality, we're not going to not give it to you. Like, love those. Oh, one-liner. Didn't address the limitation. You win. Thank you, Evan. I'm not going looking for it. You know me. Like, I wasn't on anyone's side. That was my problem. Kind of wind up coming back, getting bored, I guess. But I like being on a side. I like being able to say I won. And when you're at the board, you're just a referee. You don't ever win. And there's always one side telling you you're a loser. Either the examiner says you're an idiot or appellant. The guy that lost is never happy. They're never saying, you know what? He's right. It really does teach it. No, you know, they're never coming back with that. So everyone likes an easy case. If you give me short and sweet, this is why I win. I'll write you up a short and sweet decision saying you won. And, you get a full count for a request for reconsideration. Those are easy to write up because you just did the case. So if you think it's possible, file it. There's no fee for it, right? Pretty sure it's not. You're not hurting anyone's feelings. There's no one's, oh, I can't believe you did it. Most of the time you're like, ooh, request for reconsideration. And you got to take it right away. You have 4 months to get the decision out. Most people just grab it as soon as it comes in, because it's fresh in your head. Everybody looks, because nobody wants to be wrong. So they're really considered. And if you have a good argument, if you got a medium argument, if you just want a new grounds of rejection, ask. Doesn't cost me nothing. You know what? That's iffy. Give it to them. Like, what do I care? You just saved yourself an RCE. File it. I got to count for that. And it's still like a one paragraph. I don't think it needs it. But in the interest of justice, whatever, that little, there's some standard flower little thing I used to have to cut and paste in there. I'll give it to you. New ground. We changed the decision to be a new ground of rejection. Everybody's happy.
So I think the bottom line is, don't count on just getting lucky at the board. The judge is there. Take it seriously. If you have a clear argument about why you should win, then consider appealing, but do that after you try with the examiner.